Running an online business is hard enough without the stress and time consumption of managing hosting. Whether managing one WordPress site or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions offer speed, enterprise-grade security, and an intuitive dashboard. With 24/7, 365 human-only expert support, get peace of mind that your sites stay online, secure, and performing their best. Start today and get your first month free with migrations handled for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's KINSTA.com/podcast.
So you guys made it to part three. Oh, by the way, this is part three of three. So if you haven't seen part one and two, the link's in the description. I would recommend you check that out first if you want to understand what we're talking about. But guys, this is so mind-blowing. And obviously, if you're in the short season camp, you know how mind-blowing it is. Even if you're not, it's pretty crazy. But before we start, if you guys like this content, please hit the subscribe button. It would really help me out. And if you're listening on the audio-only podcast, please give me a five-star review. I really appreciate it. With that being said, let's go part three.
So we have seen in areas reaching from Scandinavia to Mesopotamia that material culture, some 700 years apart, looks very much the same. And if we go to the end of the first millennium, which is the so-called third catastrophe of the 930s, we even have very similar results for the end. So London, we look here at London, that's a 154-meter basilica in 2nd century London, as long as St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. And you can see parts of London were already covered by a horizon of dark silts, often described as dark earth. Land was converted to arable and pastoral use, or abandoned entirely. So downtown London turned into agricultural land like downtown Rome. And now we go to Pliska in Bulgaria, and again we see a dark gray layer had strangled Pliska at the beginning of the 10th century. A city of the dead had, between the 11th and 13th century, covered the lion's share of Preslav. The entire city area turns into a burial ground for the dead. But the architecture of the 2nd century here and of the 9th century here in Pliska is indistinguishable. We come to the end of the millennium, or to the end of this lecture. The question is if something happened before the 930s that was big, but not as big as the big catastrophes dated to the third and the second. And there was one, it's in the 860s, is the crisis of Marcus Aurelius with a plague. The emperor himself died of the plague. We have a repetition in late antiquity, 290 years later, and again we have a repetition in the 860s. So if, again, we assume that these three periods that are chronologically on top of each other, stratigraphically are parallel, you can see, yes, there is a major crisis, and we have invasions here, and invasions here, and invasions here. I look just as two examples. Here you have invasions of the Xiongnu and the Quadi. Here have the Huns and the Goti. Here have the Hungarians and the Vikings. And they all enter Italy, Friulia, Italy, Friulia, Italy, Friulia again. So from three different sources, I assume, we are always looking at the same invasion. And this is what in Germany is called the Völkerwanderung, or the migration period. And then, of course, in the 230s, 530s, 930s, we have these three catastrophes. And again, I say stratigraphically, they sit in the same level. So we can only understand the first millennium if we follow stratigraphy that forces us to admit that what we now count as the year 160 is more or less actually the year 860. Thus, the Viking sites, they are more or less dated correctly, but the Roman sites and the Byzantine sites, they are dated 700 or 400 years too early. So what did the survivors do? Very simple. In the cities, they did hide under round structures, because whatever hits a city, a tsunami, a mud wave, whatever, it will destroy walls, longitudinal walls, but round structures, like around a theater or at the end of a circus, has a good chance to survive. And you can see here Rome before and after the catastrophe. Again, it looks a little bit like Hiroshima, but there's already reconstruction done, and you can see how this theater, the rest was destroyed or covered in mud, is turned into a little city. They built a wall and a gate here, and in the theater steps they built small huts. This is Rome. This is the same in Calabria. It's an excavation report. Here you see in green the little huts built right into the theater. This is in Spain, in Tarragona, Tarraco, where the buildings were built into the circus. And in the wall of the circus, they had also dug a little gate to enter there. So that's a way to survive. And I quote now here how the spiritual situation was. And I quote from Strzelczyk University of Poznan. He said, the 10th century was the age of iron, the dark age, in the sense of more primitive relationships and the lack of enlightenment of our 10th century ancestor, a period of renewed and universal anarchy and social relationships came. The development of Latin Europe became retarded. In the period from about 920 to 960, nothing of any great interest in the fields of intellectual development or literature appeared in Latin Europe. So if 40, 50 years, no scholarly texts are written, then knowledge is simply wiped out. And aside of these structures in the remaining ruins of the city's round structures, what we have is an explosion of monastery building. And of course, the monastery existed earlier, but that nearly all of Western Europe was covered with monasteries, that started in the 10th century only. It is not understood why this is the case. And my explanation is a pretty simple one. Remember, there are no written sources for this 10th century catastrophe, and I think we have to look at the sources that exist for the 3rd century and for the 6th century, because these three catastrophes are side by side. And there we learn that the population losses could run up to 90%. Maybe average 40, 50%. So you had survivors, but you no longer had functioning entities, social entities. You had rich and poor. You had slaves and masters. You had pagans and Christians. And they would not have talked to each other before. Now, to have a chance of survival, they had to find a common ground. And some Christian egalitarianism was the foreign ground that allowed them to work together and to survive in a non-monetary system. The monetary society was struck too. So you had this kind of Christian communism in the monasteries. The military men, the knights, they start with their castles on the hilltops, with drawbridges, with moats, a kind of structures that did not exist in the first millennium. And even the villages are located up into the hills because the people feared that something bad would strike again and hit them too. We are now in the High Middle Ages, 11th century, and these are images of a church close to Rome, of Gaeta. And people who moved into the church on their right side, they could see this monster. Here on the right side, they could see this monster devouring a human being. And when they came out of the church, again on the right side, they could see the monster releasing a human being. So it is the imagery, for example, of Jonah and the veil that was used to remind the faithful of what they had gone through and what might happen again if they are not faithful. And the most important text for the next, I would say, 900 years of Christianity becomes the Apocalypse, the Revelation of John. And this famous text, you know it all, a mighty earthquake took place and the sun became black like animal's hair sack, and the full moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth, and one third of the earth was burned up. Something like a huge mountain burning with fire was hurled into the sea, and one third of the sea was turned to blood. A huge star fell from heaven, burning like a lamp, and it fell on a third of the rivers, and a third of the waters were turned into bitterness, and many of the people died from the waters.
A lot of information there. So now we're talking about London was covered by dark silts. It's explaining the city, Roman city of London, the right in the center, buried. And at the same time in the 9th century, Pliska in Bulgaria was also covered, and it has the exact same architecture as the 1st century. So it's likely the same event, a literal mud flood, dark grey matter, silts burying buildings. And he goes on to show
mud
examples.
Mud and fire.
Yeah, yeah. Huge destruction, cataclysmic event, burying buildings, destroying, just wiping out places. And he says here, destruction, depopulation, buried, and invasions. That was basically the repeat pattern throughout all these three supposedly separate destructive events, as we mentioned at the start, the three cataclysms. They all had the exact same format in the 1st century, 5th century, 6th century, and in the 10th century, 9th century. It's always destruction, depopulation, burying, and invasions every time. Likely the same event that they've just separated. We're talking about tribulation here, and even he equated it to that at the end of his presentation there. This is Revelation, basically. Even me, as someone who isn't a Christian, is what he's saying here is the people at the end of it all really took that seriously. Because they witnessed something, you know what I mean? Just perfectly akin to it. And it had plagues as well, everything else, just mass destruction. And then he shows an example of what we should see prior to the 10th century. It shows the Roman city, the rounded part of the amphitheatre where people, which survived, because obviously it's round, it probably handled a mud flood better, it would disperse everything better. Yeah. It shows once it was buried, people built on top of it. But we don't see any evidence of that to history prior to that event. Only after the 10th century do buildings begin to get built on top of Roman ruins. Nothing prior to that. No strata before that. There was no other civilization, it turns out, before Rome, is what we're learning here. Nothing else was built before them, which is ridiculous. Like, that's basically what the evidence is showing. And it's incredible. And like I said, he talks about it was an age of iron. And he says, and they try to, historians have tried to explain this time as just no advancement, darkness, misery, just no intellectual, no poetry being written, no books being written, nothing of documentation we could look upon to find any evidence of what was going on in this time whatsoever. Everyone must have just been killing each other and fighting each other and dying, and it was just awful. And there was nothing of value to report until the 10th, 11th century, where suddenly we have civilization again. And what do we get? Monasteries built everywhere in the new Gothic style, with the arches higher at a point, no longer round, like the Roman style. There was a new inspiration. Something changed. And he's saying people must have been in fear of what happened, so they built these things as like sanctuaries to remember the horrors of what had just happened or something like that. And they and all they knew, it's after Christ. That's all we know. So they just lived in fear of Revelation from then on coming again. Like, so that's why there was a sudden conversion to Christianity. That's his best explanation. It's kind of a, now, well, obviously we're saying something a bit different here now, aren't we? This is where
I don't hate the way he explains it, because I think that, again, we don't know how everyone reacted afterwards, but it does make me think when monasteries basically kind of hold the world together and save it. You know, it's like, doesn't that kind of make you think of like the meek will inherit the earth? Well, you know, they're living in this cashless society, and it's literally it's only the goodness and the love of God that uses Christians to even save the pagans during this horrible time.
Well,
of like
people
just
wandering around, you know, after utter destruction,
after the apocalypse. Yeah. You know, it's absolutely insane, but this makes all the sense in the world to me. It makes sense that, like, so I'm even saying at this point where I might not even attribute all of the timeline nonsense to nefarious acts of the devil. It's almost like where you could think like you have a small remnant that survives this apocalypse, and then maybe the next generation would have no clue where they're at in the timeline, so they would, hey, you know, what's described sounds a lot like this book. And they say, that's about 1,000 years. So they the only thing they know is it's been 1,000. You know, the only thing they really know is it's after Christ. Mm-hmm. And so then they would go back 1,000 years and they would say, well, 1,000 years ago was year one. So we're living in around year 1,000. And then they would just move forward. And obviously they would go about their lives. And they said it's only later that there was an attempt to fill in the history mm-hmm. of the 1,000 years. You know what I mean? Like, it actually makes sense in the way that not everyone is trying intentionally working for the devil to try to distort history. It's literally like the world's worst act, you know, the world's worst time just happened. And it reminds me of, like, I was told to watch that movie, The Book of Eli. And if you guys have watched on my channel, I said that movie sucked.
Yeah.
But it was interesting in a certain way that there's one Bible left on earth, right? And one man's trying to use the Bible to control people. And the reason I say it sucked is because the twist was dumb. But I thought it would be a really good message if the one guy was trying to free everyone during a horrible time. But you could imagine if during the times of like a movie like that, you're in the post-apocalyptic age, the next generation of people who did not witness the apocalypse would start to read the book and they would say, where are we in this timeline? Because mm-hmm. obviously we all believe this happened now.
Yeah.
And yeah, it makes sense that you would say, well, the book of Revelation happened. So we know that Jesus must've been a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because it was nothing like this and nothing like this is described until this book that mentions 1,000 years and mentions other things afterwards. And people would say, well, this makes sense to me.
It seems like he conflates the 1,000-year reign of Christ as coming before Armageddon, but Armageddon happens uh-huh. before 1,000 years. And then after 1,000 years is the little season where there's the Gog-Magog War. It seems like he's confused Armageddon with the Gog-Magog War and then seeing the 1,000-year gap between the two and thought, okay, so that's why they put it first century 1,000 years ago. But when we read the book, we don't see that. There's a specific timeline of events and Armageddon happens at the end of the tribulation. And it lasts about
I agree. I think that's what people need to understand is like that we obviously don't agree with him on everything he says.
No.
I think his lack of understanding of the Bible, obviously it's really hard to, you know, for lots of people conflate Gog Magog battle with Armageddon.
Yeah.
Even Christians, they're not sure about it either. So like
forgive him because it's the predominant view of Christianity even today. So he's just going off what he believes people believe, you know, but what we're doing is saying that's wrong. Tribulation happens and then there's 1,000 years of peace or monasteries appearing out of nowhere, saving everybody and building a Christian nation where everyone knows who Christ is or however you want to describe it. There's 1,000 years mm-hmm. where the devil's locked up after destruction where people can rebuild under Christ as he is the king, he is the ruler. And then once that ends, Satan's released again for a short season. And then there's another war. A Gog-Magog war, and we've got our own theories on that. You know, go check out the videos of what we've got going if this is new to you, but he seems to conflate the two in this presentation is what I'm saying, and he's using the 1,000-year period to explain why they made up the first millennium to be wrong when we only have 250 years worth of history, but they've made it 1,000 years, probably because of Revelation is what he's saying. But that doesn't actually make sense when you read the book of Revelation.
Yeah, no, it's all incredible that it all kind of just lines up in a certain way that it makes sense that if monasteries help rebuild society, everyone would kind of accept that the Bible was true. And with that knowledge, they tried to date everything based on what they believed the Bible said.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you would have Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. It really doesn't make sense that they would change the timeline in the years of when they said they did it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like that I thought that was strange without a supernatural event that happened.
Mm-hmm.
This explains a supernatural event, but also why they would date things differently again, because I mentioned that I went to this place in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it had this weird tower. And of course I said, it's an old world looking place. It's got a Freemasonry stone on it, and it says, I think it said Anno Domini 1921, and I think it also says Anno Lumini 5200 and something. I can't remember the exact date on it. So Anno Lumini would be like the year of light. So it basically would be counting upwards, and obviously Anno Domini is counting from Jesus, year one, to where we are now. Well, I mean, it really doesn't make sense without something massive happening to go from dating things upwards to deciding on a year just, you know, even if you believe in Jesus, it's kind of like, obviously, I believe in Jesus. I wouldn't say, well, we have to change everything based on when he was born. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause it's just a date. Like we remember dates a certain way. Like, it would be weird for everyone to redate everything unless you didn't know what year you lived in.
Yeah.
And you started left. To go, you were starting over.
All infrastructure was destroyed, buried, all civilization, all the timekeepers, the documents, gone. There was nothing. We were starting from scratch. Oh, but somehow they retained the knowledge of the biblical history. That survived.
Because that was the, isn't it interesting? Yeah. Isn't it interesting that that was the only thing that was left?
And it became history. To everyone at that time, it's like, this book is our history. And that was the predominant view from then on. Like, they had no
this
other
is the one
view.
Thing, yeah, this is the one thing we know is true.
Yeah. That's all they had.
And I mean, it's like I said, is everybody else's not mind blown by this? Like, this is, I think it's incredible. It makes so much sense that I get the chills. Mm-hmm. Just like thinking about this.
It's fascinating. And it's just, we think we have it bad today.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't understand tribulation like these people that went through from what we described, what we're seeing here, what happened. Like, we argue the making up tribulation today. They're making it seem like we're going through those times or it's on the horizon, and they're manufacturing an illusory tribulation style event. And it's kind of, we don't know persecution and destruction like the people who went through these time periods we're talking about went through. Like, what happened to them is just utter annihilation and a full reset. That's the word that goes around in Tartaria, isn't it? Resets. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to talk about a reset? Just read Tribulation, read Revelation, read what happens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I got to say, like, I think that to me, and I might be veering from a lot of people in the chat and people who believe in Little Season, I believe that the Millennial Kingdom has always been a heavenly kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
I think this actually points more toward the advanced society that was in our recent past was Roman.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. It looks Roman. You know what I mean? Like the most advanced looking buildings are Greco-Roman style, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it might speak more to the fact that the Romans were more advanced than we were told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they obviously had certain kinds of technology that we don't know about. And then, so if you think about it, if Armageddon happened and then the world reset to nothing, this actually makes sense that there was not a more advanced time after that.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, we have been picking up the pieces. And somebody just mentioned, so where did like the Native American Indians fit in this kind of the idea of the millennial reign? They really don't, but it makes sense in the way that if everyone got wiped out to basically zero, if they were in a place that was more desolate, then they might not have accumulated the knowledge based on the old knowledge to fall back on or the places to live in. And they were more of a, you know, feral type people that lived on the land, because maybe like places like North America experience way worse things. Like, I mean, obviously I just was hiking out in Western America. It looks so scorched and just melted and just ruined. And if that's where a lot of them lived, yeah, then they would not have experience being able to dig out the best Roman things.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not even just Roman culture. I mean, who knows, like I said, who knows how far Rome went? But you look at ancient civilizations and let's say Hindu regions or places with Hindu influence like Bali, you know, and you mm-hmm. go to like Papua New Guinea as well and the archipelago north of Australia, and you have cannibalistic tribes living in those forests and in the mountains and the hills. You know, they still paint themselves up white, wear red, weird-looking feathered headdresses and carry around spears and bows and arrows, and they're eating each other, and they're just basically hunter-gatherer societies with an odd, really odd sacrificial religion and belief system, very mm-hmm. basic. But they're next to civilizations with ancient temples and amazing architecture and unbelievable yeah. things. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, mm-hmm. how did that happen? Did their culture not live side by side with amazing advanced people who built the most beautiful, oddly designed, creative temples you've ever seen? Like, have you seen some of the temples that are ordained with Rakshasa, Nephilim demons and dragons and all these type of things that surround these nations? It's kind of like, how do they exist? The only thing that explains it is mass reset destroyed those civilizations, just wiped them out and stopped them from being functioning. Then they just became pretty decorations that got covered in overgrowth of moss as the years went on. You know what I mean? And the people...
Oh, absolutely know what you mean.
The people had nothing,
it feels,
you know?
It feels like things got reset to zero, and if you had a more Christian culture in like the cradle of like kind of civilization in Europe, then those are the places that flourished after this time.
More stuff to back engineer in Europe, because it was
you think about it, so if you were closer to the Holy Land, or whatever you would call the Holy Land, or in Europe, where it was Christianized, because so obviously there's lots of proof that that was Christianized. We don't really know so much about the different parts of like South America, and so much as like, well, actually there is evidence in South America, but like you'd say like maybe like in China and like India and places like that. So what if those places and certain parts of Africa, those places did not gain traction as quickly. And that's why the Europeans were quickly after the reset, they had a leg up. Because of the monasteries, because of the Christians, who the support through the thing, and the meek inheriting the earth and all that kind of stuff. I think it all makes sense. Well, I think it makes perfect sense.
In terms of timings as well now, and we'll carry on with the thing in a minute, but obviously we're talking about 8th, 9th, 10th century. So we're talking 700s, 800s, 900s, roughly, give or take, is really the first century. Those years don't actually exist.
Jesus, based on this kind of timeline, Jesus would have been crucified in like 833.
So let's go, because the second millennium, we do kind of have historical records of the advancement of people from that point, from the monasteries onwards. There's not much, I don't think there is much timeline manipulation there as much as we think there is, but there will be. There will still be issues with it, lies, cover-ups and so forth, and different name issues.
Right.
But what we're talking about here is 1,000 years from 800 to 1800s, and it seems like the 1800s is when it was all hip and happening with the secret societies popping up and takeover and everything like that.
That's actually a really good point, because we always comment that the 19th century is the goofiest century. It's like it's everything said to happen, then it's all the weird stuff's happening. So if you think about it, and this is how I believe it, the millennial reign is. I believe that it has something to do with, obviously, once Jesus took the right hand of the Father, he returned in the century that he said he was going to. And so the kingdom was established then. So you have this 1,000 years where the devil's bound. The Christianity obviously makes sense in this view too, because Christianity spread right away, including to the Roman emperors, like Constantine. Yeah. Whether you say he was a great Christian or not, I don't think that that's so much. Like, we're not going to judge that guy based on that. The point being is, like, people converted. So that, to me, makes it seem very clearly like the devil was bound, so he was not allowed to deceive all these people. Paganism was being eliminated around the whole empire, and then the end came, and then after the end came there was a reset, and then you get 1,000 years after Jesus, that's when everything goes crazy, and that's when everyone's lying about everything.
So it really is the year like 1-3 something since Christ. That's what we're saying here, basically. It's not the year 2024 since Christ. The first century is the 8th century. They are the same time. Remove that time is what we're saying here. It doesn't exist. It never existed. They're all describing the exact same events, and it's been separated and stretched out. But that would place us in the correct time.
Somebody just made a good comment.
Go.
Look, so he said 1776, and of course, a lot of people mentioned that, would be like 1076. So then if you think about 70 AD.
Yeah, then 6 years tribulation and the rest of you want to give that timeline
like
as well.
You kind of get into that kind of stuff, and it's like, we really are talking about all in right in the same range.
We need to start writing our dates now as two halves. So it's like, you know, in 800 AD / 70 AD, this happened. And then we can go on from there. And it's like, you know, in 1000 AD, was it / you know what I mean? We need to do double timings now so people understand what we're actually saying here. And this is, this is where it gets convoluted and complicated. But I think we're kind of making it clearer today, aren't we? But this presentation is helping us make it clearer.
Like I said, I thought I kind of was understanding it, but I think the more we watch it, the more I'm fleshing it out. I'm like, I really am getting a good view of what this means.
Because people always say to us, there's no evidence tribulations happened. We know about it. It's kind of like, there is. There's plenty of evidence, actually.
And that's why you don't know about it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Isn't that funny? It's like, it's exactly the opposite of what they would say. It's like, well, people would have wrote about it. It's like, everything was burned up. Everything was covered in mud. No, they would not. Yes, they would have wrote about it if they had survived.
Well, they want a book. I would say, let's look at the strata instead, shall we?
We've got a book. It's called the Book of Revelation. And the people who survived survived it said, yep, this happened.
Mm-hmm. But they want the book to be written by somebody in the time with a timestamp date saying this is happening now and it's all happened and, tribulation's happening now. And it's kind of, people didn't think like that then. And the dates they would have written down aren't our calendars. And none of it would make sense as you want it to make sense. And they didn't see history like we see history. Chronology, as we understand it, is an invention by us. That's new. That's a very new concept for most people. Most people lived in a nebulous now, a constant now, with loose dates. And all they knew was it's after Christ type of thing. And they start dating from that point because that's all they know. It's kind of, people didn't see history like we see history. So there won't be that ace in the whole book that just tells it all. We have the Bible, but people don't want to take that, do they? That's not enough. That's not good enough. And it's kind of like, all right, well, let's look at the evidence with our eyes. Forget the book. Let's look at the archaeological evidence. Is there? It happened.
You know what? I always want to say this, and obviously we have quite a few people in the chat right now. What do we got? How many? We got almost over 500. I'd like to just ask people at this point if there's people that are still doubters. You might doubt the timeline stuff a little bit still. I mean, I don't know how you can, but if you do, there is still a worldwide cataclysm. Like, so what do you do with your book that says all these things are going to happen soon, and it makes no mention of a world reset in the middle of that?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I feel like that's kind of like a game changer when you see that this is not... I think that a lot of people deny preterism in general because they say, oh, well, 70 AD is related to Jerusalem only. And then so it can't be that because Jesus is kind of describing something bigger than that. I mean, he's clearly describing the destruction of Jerusalem, but people have said, oh, it's the world, the end of the world, the end of the age. This has to be something bigger than that. There's nothing bigger than what this is talking about. This is like literally a world being burned up and covered in mud, and then a reset back to monasteries nursing society back to some kind of form of order.
Mm-hmm.
That sound like that. I don't think you can look at that and say, well, that's not biblical.
Completely Christ centric order. Like that's pretty incredible.
It makes sense in the way too that how did the world become Christian?
Hmm.
You know, I mean, I think that I said, I've tried to really wrestle with that, like without some kind of supernatural act of God, because it's kind of like that how much different are people than they used to be? Like that if some people would say, oh, you believe a guy rose from the dead? That's crazy. But people accepted it. You know, it's like some guy from this certain region that you're not from rose from the dead and he died for you. Like what?
Mm-hmm.
Who? What?
Yeah.
Unless you literally had the people who were saving everyone during this time were telling everyone this was true. And that's why people became Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone would, nobody would have any doubt that the world ended or changed, because you'd say, did you see that great building that's covered in mud, or that one place that's completely scorched? That's from, read this.
Yeah.
And they would say, I don't know how to read. And they would say, well, I'll read it too. you know what I'm saying? Like that's like the level of like what you're dealing with, because things really did get reset to almost nothing.
Yeah. What's a book? It's that type of thing. Yeah. All right. Let's carry on with the presentation. But yeah, that was good. I'm going to press play now.
Let's go back to the loss of knowledge. Here I show you celestial globes of 150 after Christ, of 150, 230 after Christ. So you can see from these instruments that the Romans were perfectly capable of watching and recording the movements in the sky. To do this, you need an atlas of the sky, and you need to know your position on the ground. You always need to know where you are, and then you can follow movements and record them. For this, you need these instruments. So the next time we see globes like this, we are in a period 600 years later in my chronology. That's a shorter one by 700 years, and 1,300 years later in mainstream chronology. You get an impression how far-reaching the catastrophe had struck. Here we see something even earlier from 70 BCE. That's the so-called mechanism of Antikythera. And it was an instrument for predicting astronomical positions, eclipses, and the cycles of the Olympic Games. So this is what you see in essence in the museum. I took the photo last month. And this is a reconstruction of this instrument. And it could show you the position of every planet, the sun and the moon in the sky. This is the kind of knowledge that we lost. And the loss of this knowledge brings me, or at least you, to the question, so how was a return to counting of the years managed? And I believe in a very simple one. I'm not in favor of falsification, of faking, of just creation out of the blue sky. I think when the catastrophe shook somewhere around the 930s, there was no scientific activity up to the 970, 980s, maybe longer, then someday people would start counting the years again. And what did they know for sure was they were after Christ, that they understood. And I think they decided to choose a year as a new year one. And this year one is turned later in the year 1000. And why 1000 years, they might have thought? Because in the revelation of John again, it is said that after 1000 years, Christ and the devil in the valley of Armageddon will battle out the final fight in a major catastrophe. And maybe, it's a speculation, this catastrophe of the 10th century was seen as this after 1,000 years the devil and Christ are fighting it out. And so they had a basis for a year one. And only later arrived the desire to fill these 1,000 years with history. And that's when the composition began. So the authors had the very few sources on their table, and they had to put them in a sequence. Even in actuality, they lived in parallel.
There we go. Sorry about that. A bit of a technical hitch. Yeah, I think I should have put a title in there and I didn't. That was the end of the idea about how did they start dating again. And they just worked backwards and tried to create a chronology of events the best they could from the remnants of the ruins. This remains all around them, basically, based off this 1,000-year principle. And that's where he conflated Armageddon with Gog Magog, I think.
Yeah, okay.
And he even says, after 1,000 years, Jesus and the devil fight it out, is what he says. And that's not really kind of what happens. And that's Armageddon at the end of tribulation before the 1,000 years that he's talking about.
Yeah, it's like I think in the Battle of Armageddon, what's interesting is like the devil really does not fight because he gives his authority over to the beast. And he doesn't really go into the fight until Gog Magog.
No,
what
exactly,
I find interesting is what he's saying is like that they had these globes. And if you kind of look at how they're actually astronomical. And if you think about in the view of a firmament, mm-hmm. it actually makes sense that it's a globe.
People started arguing in the chat. They're saying that's all fake. The earth is flat, blah, blah, blah. It's like, they're not globes. They are maps of the stars on a sphere.
Yes. You know? Well, I think what's interesting is, like I said, if you ever seen those depictions of like the biblical cosmology where there's a flat plane in the middle. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you kind of like made it a little more opaque, you could see the earth. And so these things kind of rotate around the earth, mm-hmm. and they go, you know, that's why like it might be obscured from your vision. So like it might be like you might have a different kind of a like cosmological globe for your region, because this is when it dips down, you know, like these certain constellations dip down below you. Yeah, because it's not really those things actually do not make sense on a globe.
No.
You know, they don't make sense on an actual like a globe Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense in a globe cosmology. And I think that actually it is funny to think like that people could just be kind of talking past each other, where it's like we live in a globe almost, like, or at least a half a globe, but it's something that's how the stars move. So it might as well seem like a more like a sphere.
Yeah, it's round, it's a circle, but it's in the middle of a sphere.
Like right. So you have waters below and you have waters above, and you kind of live inside the sphere. And it's like kind of like, you know, what's interesting in that kind of view is I've always heard that, do you know how low the bottomless pit is? It's as low below the earth as where heaven is,
which is a sphere, a perfect sphere.
If you think about it in that view, it's like, yeah, so God's throne is at the very top. Where's the worst place to be? The place furthest away from God would be at the very bottom.
That's it. Yeah. The abyss, we'll call it. Deep waters. Something like that. Yeah. Outer darkness, we'll call it. As far away from God as possible, in the deepest, darkest depths of the ocean, of the seas. Waters above from the walls. But it's all there, isn't it? Yeah. But the thing is, getting back to what he was saying there, people just, they just try to slap together whatever they could, which is why he thinks there's this issue with the timeline. Memory, whatever they had, people tried to make up a time, and it got lost throughout time, and then the new world kind of took over, the new Christ-centric world took over, and I think people didn't really care about history as much as like we do today in terms of chronologies and dating things, so it kind of just ended up with this. So that's kind of removes nefariousness from why our timeline's wrong, doesn't it, you know, in a way.
Well, yeah, somebody common is like, isn't it interesting how calm this guy is when he's exposed all the things we've been lied to? And I heard him on another podcast, and he basically said he understands why people dated the things the way they did. And he doesn't, I mean, because I think he's in a certain area where he's working with people, like people like who are dendrochronologists, who are not trying to, by their own knowledge, work for the devil to confuse people. But they are working based on what they know. And I think that's the same way when people say, like, how could this conspiracy be that big? Because obviously these people believe certain people, and they are working under the parameters they have, because like this is what they've learned, and this is all they know. So again, it makes sense that you could have honest people trying to, we have an established timeline, and it's like, so what happened in that 1,000 years, you know, between Jesus and all this stuff that happened? And people would say, well, it makes sense to me if we got these coins. So these different, if they could have been governors, well, maybe these were emperors and they were all acting at the same time. So people are like, well, how could they get that wrong? I already said, like, he mentions in the times of Marcus Aurelius, all the Roman emperors or the Roman documents and things were burnt up.
Mm-hmm.
They're burnt up in this fire which obviously was more likely they were burnt up in the time of the cataclysm,
mm-hmm.
not in the times they said it was. It was just like another version of things that were put. What about like the whole idea of like the burning of the library in Alexandria?
Same concept.
Yeah. Doesn't it make more sense when people say, well, what about all that knowledge that was lost?
The loss of knowledge was enormous. The loss of population was enormous. In Rome, the loss of population, I would say conservatively estimated from 400,000 to 20,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So from 20 inhabitants, one survived. Hiroshima is harmless, forgive me if I make such a comparison, but is harmless compared with that death toll.
Right.
So and I had a fallout with quite a few friends and colleagues who had decided no catastrophe in the first millennium after Christ. They had just taken the decision, and I had it taken with them. So in the creation of the gods, I didn't know anything about this catastrophe. Right. And then since 2013, it's nearly a decade, I'm following it. I'm searching for it, and I'm looking for material.
And what if, like, the stuff that's in the Vatican vault? What if that is stuff that actually did survive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that was
there must be somewhere.
Every book. What if every book that survived was put there?
Mm-hmm. We wouldn't know. I'm not allowed to go there and have a look.
Well, yeah, we would. Yeah, we wouldn't know. But I mean, obviously, we always talk about there's like 53 miles worth of shelves. So what could be in there?
Think about that concept, guys. First of all, 53 miles. Like that, it doesn't seem it when you know from the grand in relativity to the size of the Earth, it's not that big. But you try and walk 53 miles. That's all I'm gonna say. It's not an easy task to do, you know. And that's just book after book after book after scroll after document after artifact, everything. Just 53 miles worth of that. Just think about that concept. Now let's keep going with it. We're almost at the end of the presentations. Let's power through. Let's do the next segment.
And I will. A focus on Christianity. The most important figure of Christianity is Paul the Apostle, Saul of Tarsus, a Jew from Tarsus, and he directed a radical movement all the way from Israel through Asia Minor to Greece and Rome without non-Christian sources ever mentioning him. It's a major problem in Christian history that the most important character, Paulus, is not known outside of the Christian books. But there's something interesting. 700 years after Paul, there's a major movement called, they call themselves the Paulicians, the followers of Paul. And they are in Asia Minor. They are right there where Paul was traveling and founding his churches and writing his letters to. And they are persecuted. They are killed. So there was a movement following Paul. And what is interesting in this movement, in the 8th century, they are still not Trinitarians. They still only believe in God. They don't think that Jesus or the Holy Spirit are godlike. And that's the theology of Paul. Paul didn't believe in Trinity, so he did not consider Jesus as a God. He only considered God as a God. So we have here two very similar movements side by side, but now separated by 700 years. And if you bring back the sources used to fill 1,000 years from the vertical into the horizontal, suddenly you get real stories, you get real narratives. So here is Paul, and here is this movement.
Putting aside there his odd views on Paul not thinking Jesus was God, there's plenty of scriptural evidence to say that Paul does think Jesus is God. I mean, it's not hard to find, actually. You just do a Google search. The first one that comes up is Titus 2:13. He says, "Our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." So in terms of like not being a Trinitarian and all this, I don't know what he's doing with that or where he's getting that from or why he's even saying anything like that. But I do think Paul did think Jesus was God and God was Jesus and it's all one thing, one system. I don't think any real Christian denies that in any way, so I don't know where he's getting that from.
I mean, a lot of people deny. Actually, it's funny. There's so many people who are like anti-Trinity stuff, and I don't think we wanted to... What this guy's views on the Trinity and what his views are that Paul had about the Trinity, that's neither here nor there.
Not like for this presentation, this guy, no.
He was confused about when Armageddon and when Gog Magog is. He was confused about the millennial reign.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just put that aside. What he says about Paul at the beginning is true.
Yeah.
Because he's like that if Paul was this world traveler, that a lot of people believe that Paul made it as far as to Spain. I mean, who knows? He might have made it further than that. We actually don't really know. But if he did what the Bible says he did, there certainly would have been people that wrote about Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he's writing these letters to these churches, there would be evidence that Paul was in these places. Because he started churches. He started so many churches, there would be other kinds of documents that said he existed. And that's interesting, and that's why certain secular historians don't believe he ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't date things early enough for it to make sense. But again, so it says, but there is this group that follow Paul. I even think about like in Corinthians, where Paul starts off the letter by saying, "Do you follow Paul? Do you follow Apollos?" And he's like, "No, you guys follow Jesus." It's like, are you baptized in the name of Paul, or are you baptized in the name of Apollos? you're baptized in the name of Jesus. So he's saying like that, no, you don't follow me. But there's this sect that are called the Paulicians or the Paulinists, and they are in the 8th and 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now you go back to what we were saying about the idea that Jesus lives in the 800s. That's the time he lived. It makes perfect sense that stuff happened right then.
Well, first century, 8th century, / 8th century. It's still the same time. And the evidence is there now. People were really talking about Paul historically when he was there spreading his gospel.
Right. Well, it was, I'm saying like that. What I think that his, like in his view, like I said, I said it earlier in the video, but if you guys, the way he dates things, like I said, I think from just, maybe it's just because he's German, I'm not sure. Or maybe, I think he just says he dates things backwards because the history is more clear from now to backwards than it is to go forward. So like, trying to date that like Jesus lived in the first century. No, he's actually saying he lived in the 800s because he's going backwards. So in the same way, obviously if Jesus lived in the 800s, Paul lived in the 800s. The 800s were the first century as far as what we are taught.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so you would have the followers of Paul living in the 8th and the 9th century, right around the same time.
And then Asia Minor suddenly have this cult dedicated to Paul appearing at the same time. It all makes sense now. There's no longer a discrepancy. This answers
But they
that
still
question,
follow,
yeah.
But even the way he's like, it's kind of like this cult of Paul, but it's like they're not followers of Paul because they're still, even whether he talks about it, whatever their view of the Trinity is, they still worship God.
And I'm sure Paul sent them a letter explaining the Trinity view, harshly criticizing them at some point, like he tended to do with most of the churches, you know what I mean? I like the way your style, but you got it wrong here. And that's usually what Paul does, you know, with his letters. It's kind of like, you're doing good here, but you need to work on this blasphemy right here. You know, it's kind of...
Well, that's also true, is the fact that it actually is more confirmation than what you see in the Bible is that, no, the churches that Paul planted were not doing it all perfectly based on the letters that he sent them.
And also the churches he sent the letters to don't exist anymore. Just to throw that in there quickly, just to prove the point that we're trying to make here. But and they should still be there, right? If tribulation's still to come. A very simple point. Let's keep going. King Arthur's next. Let's talk about King Arthur. Let's see what he has to say.
Another question is the most famous figure that will be the end of the lecture, King Arthur of Camelot. Everybody has seen movies about King Arthur of Camelot. And what do the historians tell us? John Myers, one of the leading British archaeologists of the last century, no figure on the borderline of history and mythology has wasted more of the historian's time. And if you write to the museum in the city of Camulodunum, you think it sounds like Camelot, Camulodunum, it's Colchester, and you ask them, isn't there a relation between King Arthur and King Atze of Camulodunum? They say, no, that's impossible. What do they say? Eastern England lay in the heart of the region first occupied by the Saxons, so Connaught have been the area in which Arthur operated. Acting as a military leader of the Britons, Celtic, indigenous Britons, the invading Saxons, any historical Arthur would have had to have been operating outside the area of primary Saxon settlement. So they believe that all these areas were full of fully armed Saxons. And so Arthur could not have operated there. But you remember in the lecture that in actual fact, there's nothing. There's not even agriculture for the Saxons from 500, from 400, 500 to 900. So Saxons were there. And what is interesting in the Saxons is that they have pottery from the late Latin period, 1st century before Christ. And this is the period of Atze Domarus of Camulodunum. He lives in the 1st century BC, and he has this pottery and he has his coins. And he has the name in Greek on his coins, A-T-H-T-H, Atze. It's called Atze. So it's Atze of Camulodunum. And now that you understand, he shares the same pottery with the Saxons that are dated to the time of Arthur, but are actually some 700 years earlier. What happened? When Julius Caesar attacked the British Isles in the 1st century BCE, He was not alone in trying to conquer the British Isles. He was competing with the Germans from the areas of Hamburg, Bremen, Flensburg. They were much closer, they're much better equipped to take the islands than the British. So they were fighting each other, and the local people, the Celtic, the Britons, they were in between. And they made an alliance with the Romans to fight off the Saxons. Thus, when Arthur of Camelot, who is Atze of Camelodunum, was fighting in the 1st century BCE, he was defending his own land. The Saxons were trying to take it. They had not yet settled there. They were trying to take it. They took it. He lost the battle.
There you go. So that was very interesting. Again, dating historical figures a lot further back in time than we were to understand. So we have King Arthur, this person who was obviously fighting in the 5th century, supposedly. But there's no evidence for that anywhere. But you have this King Atze in the 1st century before Christ came around, who did team up with the localized people of Britain, the Celts, to fight off the Anglo-Saxons of the time. He was at war with these. You know, so his new chronology makes sense of it. It says it was a mess of Romans, Anglo-Saxons, and the original Celts people there from this Latin culture, which dominated a lot of Europe prior to Christ, you know, still dominating in these British Isles. And, you know, King Arthur is likely just King Atze. And it wasn't from the 5th century, it was just the century before Christ. And that's incredible. Like, when you think about it, and he explains it militarily, of why this would have been happening as well. And fascinating stuff. What do you think about it?
Well, like I said, to me it makes sense, and I could be wrong about this because I really have not done a lot of research about this, but it makes sense that if he mentions these different tribes that he, you know, basically equates to be the same tribe if you remove 700 years, that it's the Romans aren't attacking this place with and some other places attacking at the same time. Do you think the Romans would not have conquered those people that were trying to take the island they're trying to take?
Well, the Romans probably would have, yeah.
I think that the Anglo-Saxons were the Romans army. So Julius Caesar is leading a foreign army into Great Britain. They conscripted an army. And so when they conquered the island, those are the people that stayed. In the same way that if Jerusalem was conquered by Arabs and then eventually, oh, guess what? The Muslims have control of Jerusalem. How did that happen, I wonder? Because they were the people that dominated the city and then they stayed there. Because the Romans were obviously used this army. And you think about it, like in the same way that we're kind of taught about how war goes, is these armies got the plunder after they did what the leaders wanted them to do. So what did they get? They got the places. So that gives those people lots of incentive to go fight for the emperor, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
If you go fight for me, you'll be able to take this place and I'll support you. And then the idea that it is kind of crazy to think that that if we know that before basically we're told that Rome was like a full empire, Julius Caesar was not an emperor because they didn't have emperors then. So because it wasn't an empire. But Julius Caesar is the one who's conquering Great Britain. So that does kind of push the timeline out, even based on what we're taught, right? Like that's early Roman stuff based on the history we know.
The way they describe it was well established by that point. It makes sense, does it? You know,
it had to be to go from Italy all the way to Great Britain and go over across the sea to dominate this island. No, I mean, I think it all makes sense together. And it's like, I've heard that, the stuff about King Arthur, and even I forgot, there was a famous historian that wrote that Merlin, again, was a historical figure, and he was contemporary of Julius Caesar. And it makes sense to the stories where you think, that you have this, King Arthur story is like he's a kind of an underdog, right? Because he's defending his homeland against this foreign horde. Who was the horde? Because obviously you think in that time it would be pretty easy. Well, it would be easier to defend an island like that unless it was the Romans coming who had dominated the rest of the world and they were coming to take over that island. Like I said, this stuff is just like I'm kind of geeked out by this stuff. It's like I can't believe how much of this fits you know, hand fitting a glove of all the things we're talking about.
Just for posterity, by the way, I have heard theories in the Millennial Kingdom world that kind of the King Arthur Merlin world was an attempt at building their own version of like a millennial reign, and the Anglo-Saxon invasion was actually the establishment of Christ's millennial reign, and that was his army. I've heard that take before, but this makes a bit more sense, I think, what we're listening to today. I think that's more of a wishful thinking reinterpretation idea. Maybe there's more weight to it than I'm aware of. Maybe I'm not privy to more information than those who purport that kind of idea. But this does make more sense, that there was just this time period prior to tribulation where Rome was just dominating and spreading and seeming almost impossible to destroy. Seeming almost godlike, as though it was God, proclaiming to be God with full control over everything, you know?
Yeah.
To then suddenly be just slapped down by complete judgment, just
like
wiped out,
like,
you know?
Like Jesus using a rod of iron to smash this thing into a million pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to me, again, this kind of is more confirmation what I already believed, that the kingdom was the kingdom of heaven, as it mentioned in Matthew. The kingdom's not coming in ways that can be observed. So when you have the Nebuchadnezzar statue, you have, it's interesting, even they call it the Iron Age. So like you move the Romans up to that point and now you're in the Iron Age. That's literally biblical. And it's probably because they were interpreting Iron Age a different way when the people who were writing the history the best they could, they called it the Iron Age because that's the age of iron and clay. That's the age when the Romans were in charge. So during that time, there is a stone that was not carved by human hands to destroy this final empire, smashes it to pieces, and then there's a kingdom that's established that's forever. That happened. Okay, so now if you do believe that we're in the little season and you believe that there was this physical kingdom, like the Tartarian build, you know, the Tartarian kind of thing, the old world thing, I honestly don't think it fits in this worldview. I think this is where this makes most sense based on what we know, because this actually fits really well. So now if you believe that there was this earthly kingdom, you really have to believe that they just, not only did this happen, but they lied about another 1,000 years because we just removed 700, but you're going to almost have to put 1,000 in there because I think history actually makes more sense that. So why did people go backwards? Because of this. And then as they built up again, so about 400 to 500 years after this, you had the Europeans coming back over to North America and starting over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, I think that makes more sense. And you have a heavenly kingdom, you have earthly destruction, and then you have the meek inheriting the earth, and you have people, you know, like, believing in God and obviously accepting Jesus as the one true God, you know, like the God's son who sent to us and all the things that we believe, because they believe the one thing they knew was true was God's word, because it predicted all the things that just happened.
I'm still open to the idea of literal resurrected saints being around at this time, helping establish all of this. You know, I know you're getting a bit more
it could have been.
I think it's both. I think there may have been a physical and highly spiritual aspect to all this. I don't know if Jesus was walking around himself, or if he wasn't in the kingdom in heaven, or if, I don't know if New Jerusalem suddenly was visible at this time as well, which may have encouraged a lot more people to suddenly go, okay, let's what's this all about? And maybe there were people around to kind of induct people into the new way, in a way. It's like, I mean,
I would not rule out the possibility that the saints, the resurrected saints, had a hand in helping the people in the monasteries, helping the people get a foothold in like being able to do it again. Because obviously it sounds like rebuilding things after what just happened, I mean, is a monumental task. Yeah. But it does make sense why history is so murky. It makes sense why there was the massive reset and why that Romans did things that were incredible and then we can't do them again. And it makes sense why the best buildings in the whole world have a Roman style to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's like, you actually made that point. I remember one of the first short season podcasts, we talked about that. You said that it's almost in the same way or maybe not almost in the same way, the exact same way that when God is telling the Israelites they're going to go into the promised land and they're going to live in buildings they did not build. They're going to farm, you know, they're going to drink wine from vineyards they did not plant. They're going to eat crops they did not plant. So like the meek inherited what was already there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you had a Christianized world afterwards. Yeah. That inherited what was already existing.
He even says in, I think in Daniel, I can't remember the exact passage now. Actually, I made this point a lot clearer in previous podcasts. But it is explaining how the saints will be given the kingdom that was built by the 10 kings prior to tribulation. It's kind of like, It's like they'll have this, they'll have to, what is, it says the judgment for the leaders of these places, Rome, basically, is that they are given longevity, they are given long life to live through the millennial reign, to witness their kingdom being ruled by the saints, basically. And that's their punishment. So you built this glorious civilization, someone else is going to rule it instead of you, you know, and I'm going to make you live through it. You're going to have to live, and you have to see it all. Like, what we're going to do with what you built is going to be far greater than what you ever could do. And it's like the parable of the vineyards kind of there as well. You were given this glorious civilization,
yeah, right.
And you abused it. You know, you abused it to the point where the master's come back and he's reclaimed his property and he's given it to these guys instead and see what they can build, you know. So it's all kind of meshes quite well with scripture, all of this, you know. And like I said, I'm still open to the physical, mystical, magical aspect of literal saints walking around, churches establishing their name, you know what I mean? Glorified people with normal people who just barely survived and building glorious cathedrals with pure inspiration can see the spiritual realms before the veil's put over New Jerusalem. They can see Jesus up there in Mount Zion in his kingdom. It's like it's just this.
You know, I mean, I will not say moment, that's not true, know? but I do think that if the people in the monasteries might have wrote about that.
Well, how much can we trust the books would get
well,
to
that's
us, you know?
True, that's true. I mean, obviously we could say, I guess I said, I would not, I mean, because I do think in large part we did grow up in a Christian world and as we watch it deteriorate, you know, but in still like,
I get that too.
There's still a lot of people who do believe in the truth and would have said something.
Mm-hmm.
What I do find interesting is that in that kind of view as well that, gosh, I completely just lost my train of thought. But yeah, like the,
I do get the point that compared to how things just were 100 years ago in terms of moral standards, we have fallen greatly from that standard. And the standards were way higher than that prior to that time. It seems like we hit a gold standard of morality, the God standard, and we have been slowly declining over the last 1,000 years into degradation to what we are today. So it does seem like something wonderful was established in a very earthly sense. You know,
I was going to say was that when you were talking about the kings that were going to be there to see this stuff, and I can't always help, and I know I'm not obviously not the first person to say this, but you have the Vikings. And of course, if you have a V and you have an I, it's almost like you have six kings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you think that there's something like about those people that are in that part of Northern Europe that were, you know, I mean, obviously we know that, you know, again, like these are translations of things, but does Viking mean more than we know? And it does have something to do with establishment of kings.
Maybe. I'm up for reevaluating everything after this presentation. I have no idea. I think we're learning some incredible things today that are reshaping the way we consider and view history. Like, who knows? Honestly, who knows? Because obviously the kingdoms that were established after this event, you know, were very ordained by God attitude. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, it's
yeah, like
you have
the,
to wonder,
then
don't
you
it?
Have like what you have to, after this, you have like the Holy Roman Empire and you have things that are obviously related to Christendom conquering the world. Somebody mentioned again, they asked about how like the plumbing and all the other things. I guess what I'm saying is like that, this is not me saying that the old world technology did not exist. I'm saying that it just might have been Roman technology.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that they were the ones who established, because again, the Romans were obviously very advanced. So like they did build these buildings. So if they built things like the Pantheon in Rome, I do remember when I was watching a video by John Levi, and he was talking about the old Penn Station in New York, and he was showing like the ceiling and he was comparing it to the Pantheon in Rome. And I was like, it's the same. Like, I mean, it was the same.
Well, Tartarian is a story of a world-encompassing civilization of advanced technology and glorious architecture that was suddenly just ground to a halt and has been buried from history. That is the story of Rome. It's the story of Rome.
It absolutely is. I guess the real lie would be from history's perspective, or at least the how they've got it wrong is the extent of Rome and the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so this fits what the history, you know, because it's like Rome conquered the world or the known world. Okay, so what was known by the Romans? Maybe more than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
When was it? More recent. And so now, if you can make sense of that, now you can actually explain all the things. This makes way more sense than guys who were fighting like in like guerrilla style versus the British, as we're told about America, that they immediately pivoted and started building Roman things. You know, like that's like, so we're told that like based in America, like that, yeah, the colonists fought guerrilla style versus the British, who fought very like the stodgy style in their red coats and everything. And then immediately these people just turned to aristocrats where they said, I would like a Roman building here. Yeah. You know,
it's all this.
It's kind of like, it's kind of like the opposite of like what you think America starting this new thing. They're literally repurposing old things that are Roman. And yeah, when people like Elon Musk say that America's the new Rome, because it's like they were trying to, this maybe is the devil trying to establish the kingdom that was lost to him at the end of
reestablish. I would say, yeah, he's trying to rebuild Rome again.
Reestablish what was there, and they're trying to repurpose things, and that's why they kept certain things alive.
And the new world order is just the reestablishment of the old world order of Rome. I think that's what
Norvis Ordo Seclorum.
That's the aim, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. That's just, and he mentioned there as well, which I thought was quite interesting. We didn't bring it up, but in this 700-year gap, the Latin language didn't change. They were using the exact same Latin.
Nothing changed.
Just thought I'd bring it up. But shall we just go to the end of the presentation now? There's only a little bit left. There's no point in breaking it up. And then we'll do closing. So I'm going to press play now on the last minute, 2 minutes here.
So we have another explanation here. And the final question of my son. It's one of the major enigmas of Jewish history. Ashkenazi Jews, they begin in the High Middle Ages, after 930 Common Era. Later they moved to Poland, everywhere else. And the problem is that in the early Middle Ages, in their original area in Germany, Belgium, France, in this area, there is no archaeological evidence for Jews from the 8th to the 10th century. So there's a hiatus of 300 years before the High Middle Ages. So they say, if the Ashkenazi Jews begin here, and there are no Jews whatsoever in synagogue architecture for 300 years, they have nobody who could have been their forefathers. We have the same situation like in Jerusalem, where the Crusaders massacre Jews and Muslims. But in the stratigraphy of Jerusalem, you do not have Jews before this massacre occurs. So now when you understand that the antiquity, late antiquity, and early Middle Ages periods are not chronologically but stratigraphically like this, then all the hard evidence for Jews in this period belongs also to this period, where supposedly there is no hard evidence, which means that the Ashkenazi Jews are immediate followers of the Jews of the period that is now divided in antiquity, late antiquity, and early Middle Ages, but in actuality is one. Thank you for your attention.
That was the end of the presentation. Just a quick throwaway there, but where did the Jews end up after all of this? And somewhere in the middle of Europe is basically saying that. And the continuation makes sense after the displacement, because there is no gap. There's no real 700-year gap. It's just how it all ended up. So there we go. That was his full presentation. So do you have any closing thoughts about that presentation there? We pretty much covered everything about it. I don't know what much more we can say, but...
Well, we could just comment on that. It does make sense that it's funny, I'll just say this because I don't think this is not anti-Semitic. Because The line of Ashkenaz is not Semitic. So it's interesting that they call themselves that. And people always comment that, yeah, that's in the line of Japheth, Ashkenaz. We're told about the Khazars and they converted to Judaism. I mean, I'm not sure that that's incorrect. It sounds like it probably could be. We're told, I mean, you guys should research that on your own because we could get into some controversial topics, but yeah, the Khazar Empire, the Ashkenazi Jews, and yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense that why some of these things about like the lost tribes and all these weird things, it's like, maybe they weren't lost. It's like, it's hard to place them when you put all this extra time in there.
Mm-hmm.
But when you understand like what happened in 70 AD and how people would have left and they would have, you know, the remnants of them would have stayed certain places and they would have took hold. And yeah, I would just say that if anybody who's watching this, I remember, and I'll give credit to Jason Jack, who's I believe he's still watching. Yeah, he mentioned that, yeah, we're just kind of scratching the surface here. And it's like, I feel like that this is a major piece of the puzzle. Or this is kind of almost like we now have a picture of what the puzzle might look like. And so we have the pieces and we can kind of help fit them together. So I would encourage people to continue to, with this knowledge. And well, like I said, you know, you guys obviously, you can believe what you want. I mean, I think this is very convincing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But continue to research, maybe try to disprove it. We want, when guys like me get asked to debate, guys like Paul get asked to debate, we want to try to disprove this stuff first. Because when we go into arguments with this or we try to prove it, I think we'll be ready. I really do believe that I have kind of all I need to know as far as like have a foundation of what we believe. We have the first century stuff that maybe is the 8th or 9th century. And then we have everything after that. It all makes sense to me. So I'm just saying like that. Maybe I'm a little bit speechless for once in my whole life. That
I agree.
There's so much there. And I just can't wait to continue to dig into this.
Yeah. Well, he's it's a shame Gunnar's not with us anymore. Cause I would have got him on to share this.
I know. I was like heartbroken when I looked it up that he had passed away. Cause I was thinking like, I wonder if he'd come on my podcast.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And give me just spit some German.
I think
facts
he would have,
me,
cause know? I found him on a few other ones. I did find him on some podcasts and it was like, yeah, I think he would have.
Well, the podcasts I found him on, they only had like 200 subscribers and stuff. So I think he would have come on. I think he would have got, been happy for the exposure, to be honest. I think he would have actually done it. And it's a shame.
I would love to pick his brain about stuff about North America and stuff like that. I would ask him all the questions.
All the questions. Yeah. But it's again, you know, so again, I don't know the guy's beliefs in the end or whatever it came to. Clearly he must have learned a thing or two during his research, which made him raise an eyebrow about Christendom, but who knows, you know, but it's a shame he's not around anymore. But he's not the first to talk about these things or give new chronologies, shall we say, in a renowned, respectable way. You know what I mean? So like he is a sociologist and economist, you know, he's a professor. He's not a nobody. He's got that weight behind him, which people need, because who am I? Who are you? You know what I mean? It's like to say these things. What are our credentials to talk about, you know, timeline deception? But when you hear someone with that academic weight behind it, there are people out there who need that to take it seriously, unfortunately, you know? So
I actually believe that what you said is absolutely correct. Cause I think that we are theorizing that. And I'm sure that you and I have both heard a million times at this point that the timeline is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But this is actually, yeah, somebody in my comment when I posted this on my community page is like, this guy came in slapping down receipts like, okay, you want proof? Here's the proof. And he's like, he's going town by town. He like, I mean, literally he's talking about 35,000 Roman sites. And he's saying there's not one example that shows stratigraphy that shows older civilizations under them. So he's literally saying that you want you got to show me proof that I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You got to dig down into the earth. You actually have to go do the groundwork to say that I'm wrong about this. So now we actually can kind of establish like that it's more than just saying like that the coins or the dates on buildings have been changed. This is actually showing you the hard science actually points to a wrong chronology. And then when you look into actual history, and they just vaguely just paint over 1,000 years and say it's the Dark Ages because we don't have a lot of history from there. It's because there is no history from those times. You know, you've stretched out 300 years into 1,000, and now we know why.
Mm-hmm.
And this explains, like I said, it's almost funny how he even casually just points out that, oh, here's Rome in 1500 just covered in mud. And
still,
and obviously people in the mud flood community are like, what is this? Like, we don't even have pictures like that. You know what? I'll bring this up, and I'll bring up this one last point because I got to go. But what I found really interesting is I heard him on another podcast, and he was talking to an Italian professor, and he was saying, okay, so if Rome fell in early antiquity, right? The Western Roman Empire fell. How did the barbarians cause it to be covered in mud and water?
Because we're going back to the first millennium, because there are some pictures of Rome in strata that I've never seen.
Yeah, and
you know, I've read the papers, but you had some aqueducts. That's something that me and Michael Armstrong from the Thunderbolt group talk about a lot, where aqueducts were buried with 7 meters and sometimes 15 meters here, and people forgot about aqueducts. And the barbarians from the story from the early part of antiquity couldn't have destroyed the aqueducts. I heard that story growing up. And well, there are the aqueducts, and nobody's building aqueducts. And like you say, there's no latrines, and the civilization.
Let's stay here.
Yeah,
maybe
go
back. So we look here at the Adria, at the seashore.
Right here.
Go back one, and again. Where did you have the coastline of Rome?
Oh, okay. Let me go forward. I know what you're talking about. Hold up. The coastline. I think I know exactly where you're going. Right here.
Yeah. Okay. So what you see here is on the left, you see a reconstruction of Rome's main two ports. One is called Ostia, the left image on the slide, and the right city is Ostia, and the left port is Porto. And today you have 4 kilometers of land in front of these ports. So you go to the right slide, and what you see in light blue, that's land today. That's not water. So the Roman ports had been moved 4 kilometers away from the water. If you go to the main port on the Adriatic side, to Ravenna was moved away 7 to 9 kilometers away from the Adriatic Sea. So if you try to explain this, it's very difficult, because if it's a tsunami that brings material, then you may expect such a development on the western coast of Italy, but you have the same situation on the eastern coast of Italy. And if you go further down in Italy and look at the Roman navy ports in the Bay of Naples, they are under the water. So two ports groups are away from the sea, and another port is under the water. So the geological process that can do this in a way to bend the coastlines down, up and further down, bend it down, it's very difficult even to imagine how you can reach such a result in today's landscape of Italy. So it must have been quite very big. When I first talked to specialists in the field about the destruction of the big cities like Rome or whatever, they usually said it was done by the Germanic tribes, by the Germans. But the smarter ones, when they gave the answer, they did it with a tongue in cheek, with a smile on the face, that told me that's the only answer we know. I remember I visited a very fine professor, I won't give his name, at the University of Foggia in southern Italy. And Foggia sits in a round space of wheat fields, 3,000 square kilometers. that was a swamp up to the 19th century. It was a swamp. So, and he, after he had talked to me and I have told him what I think about, he asked his pilot, who does aerial reconnaissance of the ground, and he asked he allowed me to ask his pilot. When I asked his pilot, "What did you find?" He said, "We found under the soil some 3,000, some 300 Roman estates and two towns, two small cities we have never heard of before." And I asked the pilot, "How can you explain this?" And he said, "Oh, there was a big economic crisis." I said, "But how can the crisis cover 300 estates and two cities under soil and turn the territory in a swamp?" So for them, the question was absolutely new. The idea to think of catastrophe was unheard of. You had to do it in a Marxist way, so to speak. So if there was a crisis, then it was an economic crisis, and an economic crisis could do anything you wanted it to do.
Yeah, how do barbarians create swamps?
I mean, just think about that. I mean, like, that is mind-blowing. I mean, like, where places existed, the cradle, I mean, like, basically the peak of all civilization, he said thousands of sites were under a swamp. I mean, I'll just stop. I can't.
It's mind blowing information. Like I say, it's good to have these things to kind of back us up. It's only making a clearer picture for us that we're on the right track, whatever that is. I know there are still people who probably listen today who don't agree with what we're saying. And the usual argument you hear is sort of like, you know, if you believe this, then you're going to fall for the Antichrist and the Mark of the Beast, or they're saying stuff like, you know, you're thinking too human about this. It was all magical, metaphorical talking in Christ language. So therefore, because you're being too literal, you're being fooled. And another thing you hear quite a lot is, if you're wrong, then you've wasted all your time on a conspiracy theory when you should be spreading the gospel and dealing with real doctrine. You know, you're wasting your time. It's kind of like, what about the things that really affect people and really matter? And it's kind of like, well, actually, this does really matter. And this does affect people in a big way. And I would say this is spreading the gospel, and this is bringing people to Christ. People who otherwise were so lost and have no context to understand why Christ should matter to them, this gives context. This gives them real context. Christ is no longer 2,000 years away. Where's the promise of his coming? Christ is 800 years closer, and he fulfilled his promise. He was not a liar. This changes things.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah, so 100%.
This is spreading the gospel. This is the work that needs to be done. This is breaking down dogma and doctrines that have led people astray and made Christianity weak. This is making it strong again. And I'm not trying to get all Trump on everybody there, you know what I mean? But this is what I'm saying. This is actually reviving people's faith, you know?
In my experience of so I've had two topics, and it's funny because, like, your journey seems very similar to me as far as, like, your last couple years is you're the Nephilim clown guy. So you've gone on all kinds of podcasts talking about Nephilim and weird stuff. So me and my buddy Brian made that movie Ancient Angels. And so we're kind of like, we are going against the way old history about aliens in the megaliths. So we're telling a biblical, you know, we're explaining those things through a biblical framework. And then, so now we have a huge topic for everybody is this mudflood stuff is weird. This Tartaria is weird. Old world stuff is weird. So I'm going on all kinds of podcasts and I'm explaining it in a way. And it's so funny. And I said, I know you've seen it when you explain it to them with the framework of the book of Revelation, and their minds are there. You just see their eyes because it resonates so much with people. And it's like, yeah. So when you have somebody who is going down the same rabbit holes and they actually have an explanation that actually makes sense. Yeah. I do believe that all truth eventually leads back to Jesus. So like, I believe that if things I'm saying make sense to them, the fact that I put Jesus at the front of my life, it gives people like a reason to say, hey, you know what? He's right. And if he's right, I need Jesus.
Hey, amen. That's right. That's right. It's always been about Jesus. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to get to know him and his kingdom and the truth. And he is the truth, the way, and the life. You know, you're not going to get anywhere without him. That much is clear. And this Amen, topic brother. Only brings us closer to him, as far as I'm concerned, and helps us understand his work. You know, because we always talk about his promises, but let's talk about what he actually did. Let's talk about what he accomplished, the world that was created after his resurrection and sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, let's focus on the ends, not just the means. You know what I mean? Let's talk about what actually happened. I think that's more inspiring. It's all inspiring from start to finish, don't get me wrong, but I think in our time, this is the time to talk about this. This is what people need to hear now. Mm-hmm. This is what's needed in this time that we live in. Whatever that is, because who knows? We're figuring that out. So thanks for doing this, Joe. I really appreciate it. It was a long one, but I think it was worth it. I'll cut out that 10-minute interval at the start where we had to figure everything out, and which means the chat will disappear when I do that. Just a forewarning: there will be no chat on this after I remove that segment. YouTube doesn't know how to cope with removing segments from live shows and keeping the chat. So just for people to know. So
guys, obviously go back in and like, comment, share everything, because I think this is going to be one that when people say, well, what about this? What about this? Why didn't they write about this? You can send them to this podcast and you can say, this is why.
That's what we're going for. And Joe, you now have the rights to take this podcast and cut it up into segments and do whatever you want with it. Repost. I don't care. It's all yours now. I'm just gonna do this because I am useless with like Instagram and Twitter and everything else and all the short form content. I don't know. I don't have the patience to do it. You're the man for that. So you can spread this as far as you can. Do whatever you need.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some cuttable things in here that are just gonna be like.
That's what we're saying. Yeah, and obviously, guys listening, if you don't know. Go follow Joe at JT Follows JC. Links are in the description to here. I think his name is highlighted in the title of this video. You can click on it as well.
I am 23 subs away from 25,000.
There we go. Huge.
There's like 500 people in here. I know that you guys could get me to 25. Not that huge there's anything milestone. Special about that, but it's kind of cool.
No, that's a huge milestone. Congratulations. And it's well deserved. And yeah, let's just keep doing what we're doing. It's a shame. Shout out to Vitaly. He couldn't make it. We were going to make this a roundtable three-way discussion, but he's got a new job. He's working hard and he just couldn't get
this podcast would be 8 hours long if we had all three of us.
It would be nonstop.
No, but yeah, we miss Alpha Talks. We wish he'd be in here, but I know now we have so much to chew on with him. I can't wait to talk to him about this.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And he's always fun. He'll have an interesting take to bring to it. But go check out his work. He's been doing some great stuff lately, getting into the extra details surrounding Christ's descent into hell and all sorts of things. It's really interesting. So go check out his work as well, guys. And like I said, I'll be back soon with more podcasts. I might take a break for a day or two after this one. I'm not going to lie. I do have Madeline from Leaving Babylon coming on next week.
Awesome.
So that should be a good one as well. She's got a wealth of knowledge to share with us. But yeah, thanks for being here, guys. And as always,
wait, I got a couple of things to plug real quick.
Go.
Hey, I just mentioned, so I just started recording the Ancient Angels podcast, and it's going to be on Demon Racer's channel. So I'm actually trying to get him to do something regularly. So we're going to have a podcast, and obviously, Paul, you're going to have to come on there. It's going to be about angels, demons, cryptids, giants, all the kind of ancient stuff. And yeah, I think that Brian's going to do a great job with that paranormal alien stuff. And I have a JT's mixtape coming out on Monday. So if you guys want to check that out, I think you guys will enjoy it. So
you need to get me on the
mixtape. Appreciate the opportunity again, Paul.
No, you need to get me on the mixtape so we can go through my Instagram feed. I need to share the world, my Instagram feed.
You know what? The mixtape has the right kind of just format where I actually want more people on it because I think it'll be fun just to get people. Different people's perspectives on video. So yeah, definitely. You got an open invitation.
For the context, my Instagram feed is a mess. I don't know what I've done to get that kind of algorithm
Nightmare
response.
Fuel.
But the stuff I'm getting is pure evidence we are in the little season, if there ever was one. I'm going to tell you that right now. Now I'm going to leave it there, guys. Thanks for listening. And as always, God bless.
Closer, my child.